You're with John Cleary on Sunday Night.
Well, the debate on carbon pricing in Australia has well and truly fired up. Welcome to Sunday Nights, and tonight we're going to take issue with the issue. And for those of religious faith, the issue is not simply one about the facts of a particular issue. It cuts to the heart of an understanding of the nature of God, of creation, and of human responsibility. Yet, just like every other sector of the community, it seems that religious opinion on the question of cause, effect, and response when it comes to carbon pricing and climate change in general is divided. Within the Catholic community, for example, Cardinal George Pell, senior cleric of the Catholic Church in Australia, is a vocal critic of the science of climate change, whilst some of his bishops, and even some in the Church in Rome, hold a somewhat different view. For many Christians, their understanding of the theology of creation and human responsibility for stewardship of God's earth leads them to stand with those in favour of immediate action to curb carbon emissions. For others, the use of science as a weapon against religious belief over the past century means a sceptical view of the deployment of scientific argument as if it were just another form of rhetorical device. Yet the view of church and religious communities is important, perhaps even significant. Churches are one of the institutions in society centrally concerned with why and how we should live. Importantly, they are among the few still directly connected to grassroots communities. The flock seeks ethical direction and looks to the informed views of religious leaders. With around 15% of Australians attending religious services on a regular basis, the views from the pews could prove influential. So tonight, what's religious about the price of carbon? In a few moments, we'll be joined by a panel including those for and against the issue, and you can join the conversation. 1300 800 222 is the number to ring, or if you want to SMS us, try 0467 922 702. That's 0467 922 702 to give us your SMS thoughts on the issue. In our second hour, we'll first say hi to Stephen Crittenden, an ABC reporter for many years. He'll join us for a look at what's made news in the religious arena in Australia over the past month or so. And then author, culture critic, and intellectual force in evangelical Christianity for over a generation, Oz Guinness, will join us for a chat about civil society and whether his name should be pronounced Guinness or Guinness. Stay tuned. Then there's the Inquisition, Noel and the Good Life, and in the chat room, Samini Yasmin will be along to take your questions about Islam, Australian society, and anything else you may care to raise this evening, 1300 800 222. But let's begin with a song. Last week we featured Simon and Garfunkel from the Bridge Over Troubled Waters album. Here they are again with something from a little earlier.
Through the corridors of sleep, past shadows dark and deep, my mind dances and leaps in confusion. I don't know what is real, I can't touch what I feel. And flowers never bend with the rainfall.
Simon and Garfunkel, a little view on personal integrity. Well, responses to the Gillard government's determination to move on the issue of climate change have generated a debate that is as much about politics as science. For some, it's also an ethical and religious issue, one where science meets God. So tonight, in an effort to find a little clarity and perhaps some common ground, it's good to welcome in Melbourne, Patrick Byrne of the National Civic Council. Patrick, welcome to you. Thanks for joining us. In our Canberra studio, Dr. Brendan Long. Brendan is an economist with an interest in theology and in climate change, currently with the National Disabilities Services. And in our Sydney studio, Dr. Miriam Pepper, a member of the Uniting Church and Secretary of the Australian Religious Response to Climate Change, and also an honorary fellow at the Australian Catholic University. Good to have you all with us. Patrick, let me come to you. This week, the National Civic Council, of course, we should remind people that the NCC has a senator elected with your support in the Australian Senate from the Ballarat region. So congratulations on that.
And well, the DLP actually is DLP. A separate organisation, but yes, there's a long history.
There's a long history of common mutual support.
That's right.
Yes. You put out this week a questionnaire which suggested some scepticism, dare I say, on the issue of climate change. What was the reason for putting that out?
John, one of the reason was we're very much a grassroots organisation, and our people talking to people in the electorates on this issue, you know, knowing that this is going to be a big issue with taxation and social justice issues for families and so on, found that a lot of people are very almost disillusioned with their politicians because they're not scientists themselves, and they feel that the the politicians really haven't got down to some of the just basic tin tacks of the issues around carbon dioxide, you know, whether it's a pollutant or whether it's not, you know, how much is in the atmosphere, how much humans put in there, and how much nature puts in there. In fact, when we put the questionnaire around, a lot of people didn't even want to answer it. They felt so embarrassed that they knew so little about it. And I draw this in contrast to, say, the time when the GST was being proposed. People could see up front what was going to be taxed, you know, whether they're going to tax food or not, whether they're going to tax fuel, etc. But they can't get their heads around this, and I think that the politicians have not told them just the basics about this to really get a grasp of it. So, yes, while it had some scepticism, you might say, to it, it was also really designed just to put some basic facts out there from, you know, even the IPCC, quoting them on the issues of how much CO2 goes into the atmosphere from humans, and quoting NASA just on how much CO2 there even is in the atmosphere, or its basic definition of what carbon dioxide is. So it was as much informative understanding, from our understanding, of where a lot of people are at, feeling very disillusioned with the politicians out there on this issue.
So you'd be suggesting that if people did know the facts about carbon dioxide, its role in the cycle of life, etc., they wouldn't be so alarmed and the whole issue would go in a different direction.
Look, I'll just give you one critical point. The Prime Minister keeps, and the Greens keep saying, and remember, this is a Greens policy, the Prime Minister originally said she would not introduce a carbon dioxide tax, but it came in as a result of the alliance with the Greens. You know, and Maurice Yim has been very critical of the fact that the Labor Party really should be pushing its own environmental policy rather than the Greens' policy. But it's been called a pollutant, carbon dioxide, when, you know, carbon dioxide is a colourless, odourless gas that is absolutely vital for plants to grow on Earth. In fact, during some of the ice ages, when carbon dioxide fell to around 100, almost 150 parts per million in the atmosphere, that's the limit at which plants stopped growing. You'd almost collapse the whole world ecosystem if you didn't have that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So I think, you know, calling it a pollutant when it's absolutely vital to life on Earth...
Come on, it's a matter of degree, surely. I mean, you know, obviously...
Brendan, I'll just get you to hold fire for such a for a second or so.
While we'll
allow Patrick to make his point in full, and I'll bring you in just a moment, a couple of moments time. Patrick, just elaborate that point for me. You're just finishing off the point you were making.
I was just saying it is. If you look up the dictionary definition, it's a colourless, odourless, you know, gas. It's not a poison. Most people take pollutants to mean something that is actually dangerous to human health, in the sense that, you know, you ingest it and you get a cancer from it, or it's highly damaging to, you know, like certain chemicals that they no longer use on plants.
All right, so it's
actually something fundamental to life on Earth.
And so, so you're suggesting that there is an issue of science involved. You also mentioned the Greens there, and you pointed at the link with Gillard and the Greens. But, of course, before before the Greens got involved in this space, when there was a Labor government under Rudd, which had a majority in its own right, they were nevertheless going to push for an ETS on carbon. So Labor's always been committed to this position. But why particularly are you concerned about the Greens pushing this issue? You're suggesting that there's an ideological element to this as well as a scientific element to the argument.
No, I'm just pointing it out because I think a lot of the criticism is going directly to Gillard, whereas I think in the final instance, this particular policy has been strongly pushed out of the Greens camp.
Yes, but what's the matter with that? That's
oh no, I'm just making the identity point. That's all. It's not a not a particularly ideological point in that point.
Yeah, yeah. So the essence of your critique is that the science isn't properly understood, and if people did understand the science, perhaps they would be a bit more sceptical about the need to introduce radical measures to account and to limit the amount of carbon spilling into the atmosphere?
Well, look, I think both. I think people need to be informed, you know, to have some basic figures put before them. And I think what I'm finding is most people can't answer even the basic question as to how much carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere. I'm talking about 80% of the. I mean, this is off a small sample that we've looked at. But secondly, I think they feel more confident making a decision. That's the first thing. And the second thing is I think there is a lot of scepticism about the science. And, you know, they need to be able to make up some of their own mind. But they can't make up their mind if they don't know the basics.
All right, well, let's go to that question, answer it, and try and sort of push on some of those basics. Miriam Pepper, you member of the Uniting Church, you had some experience with the Climate Institute for some time, and you're now Secretary of the Australian Religious Response to Climate Change. Let's go to that question about carbon and the carbon cycle, I think it's called, in the atmosphere. Carbon, colourless, odourless gas. Plants breathe it, actually. It's good and healthy for plants. If plants didn't have it, they'd die. They're dependent on carbon dioxide just like we're dependent on oxygen. So what's the big deal?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, Brendan probably started to say it there, I think, that, I mean, what's your definition of pollution? Pollution is a matter of degree. It's a matter of concentration, the concentration of something in a particular medium. So when the term pollution is used in relation to carbon dioxide, we're talking there about levels of concentration of this particular substance and the impacts that that has. And the science on this is really very well understood. So I think whenever we engage with these questions of science, we need to recognise that scientific opinion on this is well formed, that increasing levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, not just carbon dioxide, other greenhouse gases, are causing a warming of the planet, and they're pretty confident, very confident, that humans are causing that.
So your point on the baseline issue is that, yes, carbon dioxide is a natural gas, yes, it's part of the proper cycle, as every other gas is, but it's reaching a level where at a certain point of concentration it becomes dangerous. That's right. As everything, too much of anything or too little of anything can upset the balance. Is that the point?
That's right.
That's the key point. Right. Patrick, how do you respond to that?
I respond to that saying, look, the last time, if you look back in the Earth's history, the last time the CO2 levels were at this level, low level, we're talking about, 390 parts per million, was about 300 million years ago. And through most of the Earth's history, you know, and I've seen have in front of me a chart going back about 600 million years, the CO2 levels on average were three times at least higher than they are now. And if you go back actually to the Cambrian era, which is back 500-600 million years ago, we weren't talking about 380-390 parts per million. We were talking about 6 to 7,000 parts per million. So we've actually seen the Earth through most of its history with much higher levels of carbon dioxide than we have in the atmosphere now.
We weren't around then.
Surely it has something
to do with the amount of carbon dioxide that will affect us.
Yes, but it doesn't. Well, it's the argument is about temperature, not about its direct effect on us.
Yeah.
And it is It didn't collapse the ecosystems of the planet when the carbon dioxide was much higher levels through most of our history. And we know it goes up and down, you know, with ice ages and with warming periods, you know, quite substantially. So to me, and I think to quite a number of scientists, it's not clear that, well, it doesn't appear that this is actually a factor that's going to push the Earth's climate to any sort of crisis point.
Well, Brendan, you wanted to respond earlier, so do you have a response to the point Patrick's made? Your background, we should say, your interest is in economics, and I was actually wanting to get your opinion on some of the pricing mechanisms and other things that have been suggested by the government. But before we go to that, you wanted to get in on some of the scientific stuff. So what is it you wanted to say on that?
Oh, and thanks, John, and, you know, happy to hear that Patrick's argument in full, but I just had to interrupt earlier because it just seemed to me that we just have to understand that the position we're in is we're in an environment of highly rising emissions, and it's not really meaningful to look back what happened in the Cambrian era, but to look forward to what's predicted till 2050. And, you know, it's a rapidly rising climate of emissions in this country and in the world. So I just didn't think that Patrick was perhaps giving that reality its due weight.
Patrick, can I ask another observation here? I mean, there are numerous objections that you listen to constantly on these issues, and they're coming at you from every direction. But there seems to be a consistent line, and Miriam alluded to it earlier, that the large majority of the scientific community, it's put that there is a broad consensus among scientists, once you know the facts, that there is a really serious issue here, and that we have a responsibility to begin to communicate that to people. Now, you seem to be questioning that.
Well, firstly, science is not a democracy. You take the scientific method, you take a hypothesis, you test it out, and then the applied sciences, you then, you know, try and use various models and so on. But there's equally a lot of scientists, many scientists, who have questioned whether CO2, being one of the more minor greenhouse gases, and we do need greenhouse gases. I mean, there's greenhouse gases that keep the Earth warm, that helps us to have life on Earth. Who do dispute it?
Let's take that point, Miriam. Is there any dispute among the majority of scientists on this?
Among the majority of scientists, No. So we look at reports from the National Academies of Scientists across the globe. They all come out and say this. So I think, you know, certainly there are scientists who question this, but they're in the minority, in a very small minority.
So the overwhelming majority means, so what sort of groups are we talking about? Like, how many people in the IPCC, for example, because that's the International Panel on Climate, whatever it's called, is the United Nations body that tends to be the body that gets most focus on this sort of issue.
Yeah, look, there are many thousands of scientists collaborating on these issues. There's no doubt about that.
So, Patrick, what happens when if you're in a position where the science, the majority of scientists say, no, look, if you properly understand what's going on here, you will recognise that there are really serious problems?
Well, I think this brings into... Look, firstly, it's an applied science, and that's where you've got to use models.
And yeah, but surely they're doing that, aren't they?
Well, I think one of the criticisms that came out of the East Anglia University after its the leak of the various emails there about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, 18 months ago, I think it was now, was that the models are not in the public domain, nor are a lot of the assumptions that have been used in coming to the conclusions that they've come to. And even the former head of the East Anglia University Climate Change Unit, even he admitted later on that it was one of the problems, that these things have not been out in the pub for public scrutiny. And I think this is where this gets very disconnected then from the ordinary Australians, who then feel, well, look, you know, if we're not even told, like, basics about how much carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere, or...
But hang on, we are being told the basics of how much carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere.
Well, when I asked people, that little survey sheet we put out is actually based on another one that somebody else had done once before, and we're getting about the same results. Almost very few people can tell us just how much CO2 is in the atmosphere. You know, in a dry air, we're talking about 1/27 of 1% of the atmosphere. I mean, it's an extremely small amount. And I think people are... It's the disconnect between... One of the problems in all this is the disconnect between the sophisticated modelling that has not been made publicly, its formulas and its assumptions have not been that transparent and able for public to scrutinise. And I think that's part of the reason you're finding in the polls that people are becoming sort of, I think, very cynical about it to quite a extensive degree.
Yeah, look, I think... You know, when we head into this territory, the basic science around how the greenhouse effect works is very well known and has been known for a long time. When we look at issues of modelling and projections of temperature, yes, we're talking about complex models here, and we're talking about degrees of uncertainty in terms of how these things pan out. But the basic science is well known around the greenhouse effect and how it's enhanced by an increasing level of atmospheric carbon dioxide. And I think, again, when we engage with these issues around science and when we're talking with the public around issues of education around science, we have a responsibility to engage with those peak scientific bodies and that knowledge there. If we don't engage with that properly, we're in all kinds of trouble. Where does it stop in terms of scientific advancement and scientific understanding, in terms of what we think about technology, in terms of how this society has developed around science? Now, I think that scepticism and debate is a very important thing, but I also think it's important that we know what it is we're doing there, that we do that wisely, and that we engage very carefully and with some appreciation of what the world scientists think around these issues.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. We're having a discussion about the carbon price and in particular the way in which we as ethical and responsible communities must come to terms with these issues. How do we debate them? How do we find our way to the truth? And when the truth is there, how do we act upon it? Our guests in the studio are Dr. Brendan Long, an economist with an interest in theology and climate studies. He's with the National Disability Services, although independently as an economist tonight. Patrick Byrne of the National Civic Council, who put out a survey this week inviting people to question the levels of scientific understanding that we share in the community. And Dr. Miriam Pepper, of the member of the Uniting Church and Secretary of the Australian Religious Response to Climate Change. I'd like to get on in a few moments to the carbon pricing mechanism itself. But, Miriam, before we do, let me come to you now and ask you about why you think it's important for religious communities to have an attitude about this. And does it go to a theology, that is, a view of your Christianity?
Yes, so our Christian tradition and all different religious traditions will give us, if you like, an anthropology, an understanding of who we are as humans and how we relate, if you like, to the rest of the created world, to the rest of the earth, the rest of the cosmos, how we relate to God. Our religious traditions give us this understanding. And so whether we like it or not, we have a view about how those things interact and how those things relate. There are growing numbers of Christians and churches that are engaging with these issues and seeing that their faith, their Christian tradition, does indeed have something to say, and that it may not necessarily all be good either. There might be strands of our tradition that are problematic in terms of how we might relate to the earth. But there are other strands of the tradition that might be emphasising new understandings that are being developed and redeveloped about a responsibility to live with care and love in and on this world. I think another thing that churches and other religious traditions have emphasised around climate change too are the human impacts as well. So when we think about the most vulnerable people in this world, the people who are most vulnerable to weather-related disasters, who live in situations of food and water insecurity, there's a real responsibility there when those people are not responsible for what's happening here.
So it's both a theological or doctrinal issue and it's a social imperative. There are two dimensions there.
That's right. It's very much about how these things are linking together. That part of understanding that how we live relates to what happens to our ecology, to the environment, impacts humans as well. And that's all part of an understanding of who we are as people of God.
Brendan, let me bring you in here as an economist. This issue of climate being linked to social impacts, it's not just a matter of putting a price on carbon. It's a point that Miriam's raised there about if there is a real impact from climate change, it is going to have a direct effect on the way the economies of the world are structured.
Sure. And in fact, John, it's probably the classic case of what us economists call an externality. And that's where the market mechanisms, the normal processes of demand and supply that we're all used to, they sort of break down. And there's a cost that occurs through the normal operation of economic activity, which affects society and isn't captured by normal mechanisms. So this is the classic case of it. And obviously, that means that if the economy were to continue and, say, Australian emissions were to arise at the rates predicted, and international emissions would arise at the rates predicted, then there would be a cost to the whole world, which we would all share in Australia and in China and India and the US, that has occurred through an economic mechanism as an accident, so to speak, as a side effect. So what we need to do as economists who are concerned about the ethics of this is to try to construct an economic response that meets that ethical requirement of everybody recognising the polluting effect of their activity, bringing that, so to speak, taking accountability, moral and ethical accountability, but also economic accountability for the pollution that you cause, so that creates the incentive structure to be able to reduce the emissions. And, of course, that has, in my view, it's a classic combination of where economics and ethics can work together to solve what is, a very, very challenging problem. And the failure, of course, to respond would be an economic disaster, but it would also be an ethical and social one if we would allow our children and our children's children to inherit a world that's been corrupted by our inability to be able to manage our own environmental and economic processes justly.
And as somebody with a theological background as well, you would say that it would be a failure of the religious communities to act in concert.
When I think about this, I think a bit about Christ's golden rule, love others as you'd have them love you. And I think, what that often means is that, if you expect someone else to bear a burden for a shared cost in a community, international community, like the carbon price, then we all have to share it. And in a sense, we have to expect each other to work together, in a reciprocal way, to bear our burdens. And so I suppose I see, the response, the global response, as sort of quite an altruistic thing.
Just one point on that. A consistent criticism that's been made of the carbon price being set in Australia is that Australians represent such a tiny proportion of the amount of carbon dioxide pumped into the atmosphere or greenhouse gases pumped into the atmosphere that even though it may be high per head, we've got such a low population that really our contribution is negligible and isn't going to make much of a difference. And so,
from the perspective I'd bring, and I wouldn't be surprised if my colleagues on the panel agreed with me on this point, that, I'm not a utilitarian. I don't think that it's about just adding up the effects. I think moral behaviour, particularly on complex issues like this, needs to, work from an intention about what is the just and right thing to do. Obviously, you have to bear in mind outcomes. But ultimately, it's a response. A government must make a decision, a world community must make a decision about what is the ethical and just approach. And often, it takes people to show leadership to lead the way. And that's what I really do think is happening here, that Australia and other countries are actually taking that moral leadership, taking the response that's going to have a positive demonstration effect for the whole community. And, you know, we will eventually then build, I hope, a consensus. But someone's got to take that altruistic, in-principled, moral decision first. And that's why I think the current policy and the current decision is actually a very ethical one.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. We're talking about the ethics, the religion, and the practicalities of the debate over climate change, in particular carbon pricing. Time to take your calls. And first on the line this evening, it's good to welcome Pastor Danny Nalia of the Catch the Fire Ministries in Melbourne. Catch the Fire Ministries, and also part of the chairman, I understand, of the Rise Up Australia Party, one of those groups that supported the visit of climate skeptic Christopher Monckton to Australia. Danny Nalia, welcome to Sunday Night. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, John. It's good to be on your program. I just want to first address the issue of the IPCC, and I was just doing some background research on this, and it's interesting that 2,500 scientists submitted their papers to IPCC, out of which 600 looked at the science involving CO2. Of that 600, only 308 were a part of the second review process. Of that 308, only 62 reviewed the last chapter, which looked at what the attributes that caused the climate change. Out of that 62, only 7 reviewers were independent. Out of the 7, only 2 agreed with final statements saying they believed there was a 90% certainty CO2 caused climate change. So the major statement of this review saying what climate change can be attributed to was supported by just 5 independent scientists. Now, which means, on the contrary, there's been a petition, which you can find on www.petitionproject.org. 31,000 scientists are against this, and they say this is not true.
So if I accept what you say as true, what are you suggesting, that there's some sort of conspiracy involved here, that there is a group who are intent on foisting carbon this myth on us, and for what reason would they be doing so?
Well, it's pretty very much that's the direction I would come from, because with the lady from the Uniting Church, I respect her point of view, but if we look at the Bible. And we know the Bible is the true word of God. That's why it is in every courtroom where you take an oath. In Genesis chapter 8, verse 22, the word of God says, as long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. What it means is, as long as the earth endures, according to the Bible, God's precepts and concept is that there will be summertime and winter, there will be cold and summer, there will be seed time and harvest, day and night, and it'll never cease.
But so what are you suggesting?
And tell that to the people of Somalia right now as well.
Yeah.
Well, there's no seed time and no harvest for those people.
Can I just finish what I want to say?
Because
I lived in Saudi Arabia. And in Saudi Arabia, the heat levels were more than 40 degrees every single day. We had rain only for 7 days of the week. The earth survived for 6,000 years humankind has lived on earth.
Yes, but Pastor Danny, just to be fair, the people from Saudi Arabia get their food from parts of the earth where the climate is much more conducive. They import it. But let me go back to the question. If, in fact, the climate change scientists or the view being propagated is not correct, why is it you think it is being propagated? Do you suggest there is some sort of broad conspiracy, and what's the point of that conspiracy?
I mean, one of the points is the human race has lived on Earth for 6,000 years.
6,000 years.
That's according to the Bible.
That's not according to science.
Well, if you believe in evolution, then you will disprove of what I'm saying.
But let me take that point. So you are saying that on the issue of the age of the Earth and on questions of evolution, science is wrong.
Okay, we it's important that you look into science, but I mean, we know the world existed possibly for millions of years, but the fact is humankind was created 6,000 years, and that's what the Bible in Genesis chapter 1 says.
Yes, but that's not the Bible. Lots of Pastor Danny, I can't let you go past that point, because it seems to me that many, many Christians, many, many Jews, many, many Muslims would not agree with you. They would say that, no, the Bible isn't about scientific fact. It's about telling us about the moral and ethical framework. The Bible's not a scientific textbook.
Well, John, we cannot take off the fact that God created heaven and earth. The fact is, God is in charge of climate. For 6,000 years, he has been in charge of climate. In the last 20 years, we have had the climate change debate, which has come up. And suddenly we find this massive push to try to change the climate
last
20 years.
So what is the point of the scientists doing what they're doing?
Well, I mean, my point is, I think there is a great hype at this point of time.
About yes, but the why?
Debate. And it is an agenda being pushed by the Greens. In particular, let's look at it this way, John.
Well, hang on. But why is it being pushed by the Greens?
Because they obviously have an agenda to fulfill, and the agenda, if you look at the Christian point of view and the Bible point of view, God created man, and the planet Earth is there to serve man. God is in charge of the Earth. Man is called to look after the Earth. We cannot change the climate.
Let me
take it one step further. And, I mean, if you look at the pollution rate right now, we know that Australia, the pollution rate is very minimum. We have countries like China, India, Russia, and America, who are some of the greatest polluters. People have been telling me, you know, they said, is it good to pay this carbon tax so that we could save our environment, Australia's environment will be good. I mean, we had an ash cloud in Chile, which descended upon the Melbourne airport, and there was so much chaos. So why should we make Australians pay something like $4,550 a year out of pocket to put so much money into this project while the major polluters don't do anything about it, and it will be back to zero?
Can I actually have a go at that,
Patrick.
Please?
Brendan.
Yes. Danny, you know, if I could just have a crack at an answer, and I sort of take it from a sort of Christian economics perspective, is that, you know, this is a global problem, and it requires a solution by all people, and it requires economic approaches to be able to try to bear your cost of the burden. And that's what I think Australia needs to do, and why I support the current policies, and this is what I'd put to you. I mean, it's actually... the reason that we're doing this is because it is the ethical approach to deal with the problem that we're causing. It's not the right approach just to look at how Australia is relative to the whole world community. That would be an excuse for no small to moderate size countries doing anything. I mean, on that logic, New Zealand should do nothing, no small countries should do nothing, and it just should be up to India and China and other major pollutants. Now, I think moral people, moral economists, and I think this is, by the way, this is not being run by the Greens. Most economists in Australia support this proposal.
Patrick, your response to what's been said.
Look, I think there is. I come from this both a moral and a social justice perspective as well. And I think the first thing that you've got to do if you're doing the science is to get, if you're doing a policy like this, is to make sure that you're actually dealing with an issue, that it is a major issue. I mean, I agree that there's huge pollution problems around the world, and we've got a moral responsibility as stewards of the earth to look after those things, such as the pollution you get out of motor vehicles in Australia. I mean, it's one of the reasons I support very much going into, particularly for Australia, biofuels, particularly, you know, ethanol out of sugarcane, you know, out of an industry that's virtually going bust at the moment, but which actually helps clean up your atmosphere. And if does something, I mean, a lot of people want to do something for the earth, and people don't want to do something for the environment. If you want to do something for the environment, that's the sort of issue I think you bite into, not putting an expensive carbon tax impost on Australians and Australian industry. Now, we've had both the New South Wales, we call it head of the energy, one of the major energy bodies, and from AGL both say that we're going to have a doubling in the electricity price in Australia by 2015, simply by virtue of the huge investment that's got to go into the industry to replace a lot of equipment in there, such as transformers that are, you know, now 40 to 50 years old. Now, on top of that, I mean, I've taken some trouble to go and talk.
Treasury modelling doesn't say that, by the way, Patrick. It's about 40.
Yes, well, actually, I'm glad you said that because I'm rather puzzled about the treasury modelling, I have to say. And it's not only them. It's come out from quite a number of people. And you can see, well, people are seeing it in their bills now. The second thing is, I've been
Keep
to talk
brief,
to some
please,
of,
Patrick.
Well, I've been to talk yes. to some of the you know, consultants who work in the electricity industry. And once we go to a carbon trading scheme, where they have to pay the electricity, your major power users are going to be paying for each tonne of CO2. Just based on Loy Yang in Victoria, you're looking at around $450 million they're going to have to find. Well, that's going to come out of the pockets of Australians. It's going to come out of the pockets of consumers. It's going to hit industry. It's going to hit jobs. And, I mean, our manufacturing industry is down to 8% of GDP.
But, Patrick,
if you want
Patrick,
to drive it into the ground, that's what it's going to do.
Let me come in here. The GST had a far bigger impact than this is going to have. Yet, we survived that, okay.
Well, I think we've also got a very high dollar now. We are a lot more we are in a lot more competition with low-wage countries such as China. Look, I remember 10 years ago, Tim Kolbach in The Age writing, when Australian manufacturing was down to 13% of GDP, and he was saying we were down to the level of Greece and Turkey. Well, we're now down to 8%. I mean, how much lower are we going to go?
Well, that's accepting that there is going to be an impact on this. And the point that I think that was Brendan was making and that I just made about the GST was that they didn't have any impact, really.
And, in fact, the modelling shows that you know, that it's not going to be a dramatic impact on the Australian economy. There will be a small reduction. I mean, they're talking about a 3% reduction in GDP per capita by 2050, relative to have we do nothing. But, of course... you know, I just want to say something, Patrick. You know, like manufacturing in this country has probably been in a long-term state of decline. Services are increasing. It's interesting to note that mining is actually not, is expected to rise to substantially as a share of our output after we do these measures. So, I don't think we can sort of use trying to prop up manufacturing as a reason not to meet our international obligations.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. We've just been hearing a slight diversion on economics and climate change. We'd like to take your calls. We've got a few minutes to do that. We've heard from Pastor Danny Nalia from Catch the Fire Ministries, one of the groups who brought Lord Christopher Monckton to Australia, or Christopher Monckton. There's some dispute about his status with the House of Lords. Danny Nalia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, John.
It was good to have you with us. I'm sorry we couldn't spend any more time with you, but we're rapidly running out of time. We're going to take a call now from Matthew Nicol. Matthew, you're a member of the Sydney Youth Climate Action Network, a student-oriented network. What's your perception of the way the debate's been run?
Well, I think the youth have been taken out of this debate a bit because ultimately it is our future that the politicians are playing around with. And I think we need to be heard more, and that's why we've seen such a big commitment from the youth to join groups such as the Australian Youth Climate Coalition and SICAN. And I think that we're the generation that would rather be said to have cried wolf than be the generation that didn't take action at all.
When you hear the arguments for and against, what's your starting point? You come from a Christian perspective, I take it, personally?
Yeah, I think we have a moral perspective on it, because it is our future that we're playing with, and it's not about who's right or wrong. It's about what kind of action we do take. And if you look at it like this, if the climate scientists are right and we do experience catastrophic climate change and we don't do anything, we'll see environmental collapse, war, famine, economic collapse. But if we do take action, the worst that can happen is minor climate change, natural climate change, and then a possible economic recession. And I think if you look at it that way, you've got to look at it rationally and say that I would rather have a future for my children than have minor short-term effects in the economy.
Miriam, your response to both what Matthew has suggested and perhaps any of the points that have come in the last 10 minutes or so.
Just with Matthew talking there about choosing the option that opens up the possibility for future generations, I think probably one of the exciting things that we're seeing around this debate is the possibility for moral conversations just about that. So I think that that kind of opening up of consciousness that that brings about and the possibility that I hope we're moving towards in a context that, that has been very self-interested. And I think, you know, we see so much about, well, how's it going to impact me or my particular interest group? While all of that is valid and will come to the fore, I think that the broader possibilities for discussion around the common good are really important and actually something that's quite exciting about that. And I've got to say as well that that young climate activists, young people who are involved in this are deeply, deeply inspiring.
You're on Sunday Night. Time to take a few more calls on Sunday Night. Matthew, thanks so much for joining us. Sorry it's been so brief. We could have heard a lot more from Matthew, but we've got about 6 or 7 minutes left and a board full of calls. Tricia in Tasmania. Hello, Tricia. What would you like to say?
Oh, hi, John. I've brought this up before in your program about the World Watch Institute reports that 51% of greenhouse gases is from animal use industries and its byproducts. And, we talk about social justice and nonviolence and, our moral obligations, but everybody is ignoring this huge impact that this, a contribution towards global warming from eating animal products.
If we stop eating animal products, we diminish the amount of animals on the planet and thus reduce the amount of methane and other gases being pushed out.
Well, this report indicates that it's a huge contributing factor. Mm. Putting aside the ethical issues I'm vegan, I believe that it's morally unjustifiable to use 56 billion animals a year. And I just think, green groups and Al Gore and, the various climate action groups around just completely ignore this issue. And I think it's really about...
Okay, well, look, we'll take that as a statement. I have to move on, but clearly the whole issue of animal products and whatever is a relevant one, and it, in fact, we should have a discussion sometime about the whole issue of whether the planet should go vegetarian or not. I noticed Justice Michael Kirby this week has taken up that cause, and a number of other people too. So perhaps we can come back to that issue at some other time. Let's go to Joe in Brisbane. Hello, Joe. Welcome to you. What would you like to say?
Well, I just want to make a statement before that on
briefly.
The reliability of information. Now,
yep.
12 months ago, we were told that Brisbane would never, ever again have the dams filled because of climate change.
Yep.
Now, what actually happened is we had to flood Brisbane in order to stop the dams collapsing from the rain.
So you're making the point that science is not reliable on these issues. Miriam, this has got much debated at the time. What's the general scientific response to that issue? That, you know, we've gone from drought that will never end to floods that will just ruin cities.
I'm not sure what source of information Joe's referring to then, but we know that the eastern part of Australia is very much affected by a climate system in this region. And what we're seeing at the moment is the La Nina part of the cycle, which delivers a lot of rain to the eastern parts of Australia. So it's a country of extremes, Australia, we know that, of droughts and flooding rains. So it's one of the things that climate change can do as well is to increase the variability. So
the rising
more
temperature makes things more unstable. So you
That's
get
right.
greater swings in
you
both
directions.
You can get
directions. More and more rain, you can get longer and more severe droughts.
Okay. Thanks, Joe, for your observation. To James in Sydney. Hello, James.
Hello there. How are we?
Yeah.
Look, just in reference to the caller, the guest you had on the phone earlier, Danny, somebody or other?
Yeah, Danny Nalia from Catch the Fire Ministries, yes.
Yeah, referring to the biblical aspect, he alluded to the fact, or referred to the fact, that we are custodians of the planet and God is in charge of the climate, or words to that effect.
Yes.
Paraphrasing. Look, the fact is, if we're custodians, we're not doing a very good job. We're the only species on the planet that actually destroys our environment, that doesn't contribute anything to it. You look at every other single species on this planet, it's evolved in a whole cycle of nature which is regenerating and replenishing. We are the only ones that actually destroy our environment. And look, to tell you the truth, there's so many points to lead off from this, and the fact is, to cut a long story short, what we've done is exponentially compound that with the Industrial Revolution, which only happened, what, 100, 150 or so years ago? Or maybe a bit longer, but the point is, everything's gone exponential since then. And look, frankly, you don't even need science to tell you. We all know how much pollution we've been throwing away from industry over the last 100 or 200 years, even before we went industrial. But since then, it's gone haywire. And we just know how much is going on and how much people are still being rarely caught out dumping stuff in rivers and what have you. So we all know what was going on beforehand. We only really became environmentally aware in that regard about 20 or 30 years ago, I'd suggest.
Good on you.
James, it's Brendan here. I'm just saying the only good news about this is we've still got time to fix it.
Patrick, we've got to wind this conversation up. But Patrick, what's the central point you're making? Because it does seem that there is a broad consensus in the scientific community. What if the scientists are right? Do you think the precautionary principle should then apply, as Matthew Nichols suggested?
I think if you listen to Phil Jones, who was the head of the Climate Institute at East Anglia, he was interviewed last year and he was asked the question, are the changes in temperature in the last 30 years...
You've got about 30 seconds. I've got to warn you, the time's running out.
Well, he was asked, is there any difference between 1860 and 1910 to 1940? And he said, the changes are no different. And the temperatures haven't changed in the last 15 years. I mean, the average...
So you are making an argument that
I'm saying it's a very expensive precautionary principle to take, to put on a carbon tax and a trading system. And I think it's going to have a big effect, much bigger effect than I think Treasury is saying, Brendan, on this economy.
Last word, Miriam Pepper.
Yeah, we spend a lot on defence as well. I think there's a broad moral conversation here about how we live as a society.
We've run out of time. We've only got about 10 seconds left. Thank you all for participating in this discussion this evening. Brendan Long, Patrick Byrne, Miriam Pepper, thank you very much. We'll pick this up later on in the chat room on Sunday.